Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor of the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talisa Vanderbilt. In our bi-monthly podcasts, we interview philosophers about their new books across a wide variety of philosophical topics and areas. Today's interview is with Julia Tanne, reader in philosophy of mind at the University of Kent. We'll be talking about her new book, Rules, Reasons, and Self-Knowledge, which is just out from Harvard University Press. It's fair to say that philosophy of mind and the sciences of the mind generally adhere to an information processing model of cognition. A standard version holds that there are events going on in the brain that represent the world, and that familiar psychological terms are used to refer to these events. In this volume of new and previously published essays, Julia Tanne mounts a sustained attack on this dominant view. Taking her cue from Gilbert Ryle and Ludwig Wittgenstein, Tanne argues that reasons for action are not content-bearing mental states, and that being rational is not learning certain rules. Instead, mental state ascriptions, in particular those of propositional attitudes, have the function of encapsulating or marking patterns of thoughts, actions, and sayings. That is, understanding the mind starts from the perspective of reasons explanations, which invoke sense-making patterns. We learn these sense-making patterns through acculturation, and ascribing mental states to others and to ourselves is a practice of pointing to a particular pattern, not to an event in the brain. Let's turn to the interview. I have with me here Julia Tanne, lecturer of philosophy at the University of Kent. Hello, Julia.
Hello.
Hi, welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you very much.
So I'm very excited to talk about your new book, Rules, Reasons, and Self-Knowledge, which I sort of think of as a defense of a new Neo-Rylean metaphysics of mind, and I know you don't agree with that characterization, but we can get into that very shortly. First, I guess to begin, if you can just maybe start us off with a little explanation of your philosophical interests and what drew you to philosophy of mind and to the sustained interest in the issues that that are included in the book.
Uh-huh. Well, I guess I became interested in philosophy of mind back when I was an undergraduate, and I took a David Paris courses at UCLA on motivated irrationality, and Those were puzzles. Irrationality is a puzzle within philosophy of mind. And I started thinking about rationality and irrationality. And I sort of stayed with that puzzle as a graduate student and started thinking a lot about the literature and how you would understand what turned out to be the general problem of how to explain norms which are in some sense constitutive norms, but at the same time norms that can be violated. And I realized that if I put it in that general kind of way, the problem of rationality or irrationality ramifies now into other kinds of problems. And in fact, it's what everybody talks about in ethics. They talk about it in moral philosophy. They talk about it in philosophy of language. How can what we say in one sense be meaningful, but on the other hand, violate some meaning rules, for example. And then I got, the more I started thinking about that and trying to make some sense of it and realizing there might be something wrong with the whole way the problem has been set up. In other words, I wasn't finding any obvious solutions to the problems. It didn't come up with some sort of paradox on the terms, sort of in internal grounds, so that given the terms of which in which I was trying to articulate the problem, I couldn't solve it. So I started thinking about some of the presuppositions, and then realizing, hold on, maybe there's something going on in the framework, the way that this whole problem is couched. In particular, maybe it's when I start thinking about norms or rational norms as being themselves somehow embodied in mentality or mental states that I then can't make sense of the way in which they're violable. So at that point, I think I started around the time I started reading more of Wittgenstein and his later work, Philosophical Investigations. And I realized that he was working on the same sorts of problems throughout. And when he was talking especially about what it is to act in accordance with a rule or to follow a rule. So I spent a lot of time reading Wittgenstein. And then a little bit later, quite a few years later, I was sending off papers to publishers and journal editors, and one helpful referee wrote back and said, if this author is going to try to bring back some of these earlier Wittgensteinian or post-Wittgensteinian sorts of ideas, she's going to have to address the original arguments that led us all to move away from those philosophers. And so I thought that was fair enough. So I began rereading the concept of mind, Ryle's The Concept of Mind, and teaching that. And at the same time I was teaching that, I was teaching Wittgenstein, and I realized that there was much more of an affinity between what they were doing, although it doesn't seem like it on first sight. And I thought, that's interesting. Wittgenstein asks a question here. Ryle seems to answer it here. And then I became very interested in reading, seeing if I could read Ryle a little bit in the light of what I was learning in Wittgenstein. And then I started reading his metaphilosophy, his philosophy of language, which is was actually very difficult to get a hold of. These are his collected papers, which are now republished. And I thought, whoa, he's doing something, and he's very clear that he's doing something that's completely different from what we're doing in contemporary analytic philosophy of mind. And it's also completely different from what people are saying that he's doing. So I developed a sort of side interest in Ryle because he put some of the ideas that I had already started to become attracted to, and also ones that I felt I was learning from Wittgenstein, but he put them really very clearly. So that's about how I got into these particular authors, and then still read some of their colleagues like John Wisdom and Stephen Toulmin and Anscombe, Meldon, Holland, and find that there was a way of doing philosophy that's kind of fallen off the map today, but that if you look very carefully at what they're asking you to reject about the way that language works, you'll see that some of the problems that we're struggling with in philosophy of mind and in other areas tend not to be problems. So it has to do in the end, it seems to have to do with some of the assumptions in philosophy of language that are getting us into trouble. But my method is very different from theirs because, of course, I'm trained in contemporary philosophy of mind. So I was brought up with it, and I was brought up with that vocabulary and that way of understanding that our mental expressions do, as it were, refer to mental states, and mental states are divide into propositional attitudes and other kinds of states, and propositional attitudes are causally efficacious content-bearing states. So the whole book, in a way, is my journey away from that position, and but by trying to undo it, as it were, from the inside, taking away the layers that as I'm peeling them away and seeing how far I can peel some of them away, how that impinges on some of the other areas in philosophy of mind, like, for example, in self-knowledge, or how that impinges on some of the philosophically underlying suppositions about how cognitive science works. So philosophy of cognitive science, if you want. And also something I've spent many, many years concentrating on, which is the whole reason and causes debate.
So there's two different ways to proceed. And I think first, maybe you might articulate some of the bigger issues that you have with the dominant paradigm of cognition as information processing, before we get to more details about your positive view, so to speak. What are the biggest issues you have with that paradigm?
In fact, my position is even more radical than that. And that is that I don't even like the idea that that the expressions that we use that involve concepts like belief or hope or fear or think or know actually function by and large to refer to some sort of process. And so if you reject that sort of picture, then it comes quite naturally then to say I'm not committed to saying that a process is being undergone by an agent, for example, when I ascribe intelligence to her or any of the other kind of cognitive terms that we use. Therefore, it's not the kind of processing that goes on, or processes that go on that are modeled on a computational device either. So do you see what I mean about it being quite radical?
Yeah. And I was wondering if you could perhaps say what is wrong with that?
I think it gets at the wrong end how explanation works, understanding works, when we're trying to understand one another. I think there's a way of understanding one another that is that's part and parcel of our rationalizing explanation, if you want. That's the model of explanation where we talk about what they do in terms of why and what reason do they have for doing these things. There are many things we could mean by asking that question. There isn't just one, for one thing. But that seems to be a very different kind of explanation from the one when you start looking for causal explanation in the way that it's presently conceived, the paradigm picture in philosophy of mind, or sorry, in philosophy in general, which is the idea that causation is a relation between a relation and extension, or an inductive relation and extension between two independently identifiable events. And that whole picture seems to be not overlapping very nicely with the picture that you get from how reason explanation, to the extent that it works, how it actually works. Now, that doesn't stop me from saying that there are perfectly good things you can say about causal claims that you can make. But one of the things I'm trying to do is I'm trying to accept my opponents. Let's say you accept something like that picture of causation, and it is a pretty dominant picture of causation. Then it leads me into the search for the events that are going to be the terms of the so-called causal relation. And what happens when I can't find one of those events? Is it true that every time I ascribe reasons to somebody, I'm committed to saying that something occurred, some sort of triggering event, which is identifiable as a reason or a belief desire pair, or at bottom a belief desire pair, and then with all that picture come the metaphysical problems of how to understand how that could be both a content bearing and therefore bear a rational relation to the action, and at the same time be some kind of mechanistic explanation.
But if a reasons explanation is not a causal explanation, I take it that's what you're saying, or at least not always?
Certainly not always. Okay. And I think a better way to put it would be to say the kind of explanation that we get in reason explanation, or the explanatory burden of reason explanation is not served by seeing it as this kind of causal relation in the way that I spelled out. I don't have any problem with claims of the kind that the captain's bravado, for example, or his idiocy caused the ship to run aground. But if we talk in that kind of relaxed sort of way, nobody would imagine that among the things the investigators are going to have to look at when they examine the shipwreck is something called the captain's idiocy. So if that's a perfectly legitimate way of talking, but then once you start thinking about in a philosophical way some of those other commitments to what you want the causal relation to look like, then I think you're going to get into trouble. Now let me just say, since then I actually don't accept that dominant view of causation. I think that also gets us in trouble. But in this book, by and large, I accept that position and then show if you think that this is what causation is, then I think you're going to get in trouble if you think that reason explanation is a kind of causal explanation.
So if you, as I read the book, and I just trying to formulate your, a way to encapsulate your alternative, it seemed to me like a form of what's called instrumentalism in philosophy of science, where the role of a propositional attitude ascription is not to pick out a particular mental event in our heads that plays a causal role, but instead it's in some sense shorthand for some observable pattern. And as you put it, pattern of thoughts, doings and sayings, or something along those lines. Could you explain what your alternative view is, and if instrumentalism does or does not capture it?
It's a good question, and when I was thinking about this many years ago, I was very attracted to the instrumentalist position, one thing that I do worry about it is that it actually makes a move in a kind of philosophical discussion that I'm in the process of trying to reject. So let me put it to you in this kind of way. Go back to you're coming from a philosophy of science point of view, but if you think about Mackey and what he says about normative properties in ethics, and he says they're very queer indeed. In a way, I would like to agree with them wholeheartedly and say yes, they are queer indeed. But rather than saying that, going into something like an eliminativist position, and on some versions of instrumentalism, and say therefore they purport to refer, but they in fact don't, or they purport to refer, but they what they refer to is a mere fiction. My move is a little bit more radical, one that says they don't even purport to refer. You're misunderstanding what the role of some of these expressions, what the role is, or what the roles are, and it's that way that I don't think that either I or, for example, a Wittgenstein or a Ryle can even be accused of the position that's closest to that in philosophy of mind, which is the logical positivist view of behaviorism. It's not the case that these mental... here's my positive view now. It's not the case that a mental attitude description is just identical to some sort of pattern or behavioral pattern. Mm-hmm. It's our way of making sense of something, our way of making sense or way of abstracting over all kinds of possible patterns of the very familiar kinds. And therefore gives us some kind of way of categorizing it and putting it into a sense making context where it wasn't before. So just to use an example of pride, just a character trait explanation, when I say that it's because of her pride that she refused to allow us to pay the bill, I am referring you to a way of looking at what a person, not just this person, but what a person in general, the kinds of things that she would be doing. By the way, if you were interested in finding out what those kinds of things would be and how various they are, multifarious they are, you'd want to read Pride and Prejudice, for example, because that's a lovely study on the notion of pride. This is something Ryle is quite clear about as well. But that's not to say that pride just is. It depends on what you mean by is. So if you think that pride is something to be added in our list of ontological things, then you're going to be disappointed because it's not a thing. It's an abstraction. But it's an abstraction that's got an explanatory message to play. It's got a certain kind of a story to tell with it that helps you to see the actions in a new light, if you want. A new light. And what's that new light? Well, I'd have to talk to you and give you the story that I would give a young child about why people or how people act when they're acting from pride.
Okay, so the two sort of questions come up at this point. So, for example, to continue the pride example, you say pride is a tool to categorize ways of acting, thinking, and feeling, and you've just described that in a very very clear manner. So one of the questions that's going to arise is since the elements of what is being categorized include mental things, mental items such as thinking and feeling, how are those things going to be explained within your view? Because that it would seem like, or sort of somebody from the more dominant view might say, well, that's fine. There are plenty of uses of propositional attitude descriptions, trait descriptions, and so forth, which can be given this sort of practices gloss that you do. But what is going to be included in those ways of acting, thinking, and feeling are the types of are the types of cognitive states that I'm talking about. You know, me, the information processing person. So are you leaving room for an information processing account in addition to this account for certain uses of propositional attitude, expressions, and character traits, and so forth? So what is your relationship to the thoughts and feelings that are included in the items, the patterns that are categorized when pride and propositional attitudes and so forth are used to categorize those?
Good question. So you're right to say that the example of a character trait is just a kind of an easier way to see the general idea, which I think is a story you can tell about propositional attitude ascriptions, such as so-and-so believes that such-and-such or wants that such-and-such, or even with some complications, knows as well. And you're absolutely right that this is the kind of pattern that I'm talking about. When I say that Carrie, for example, believes that that she believes in a mechanistic story about the mind, and somebody else says to me, "You've made a claim," and I want to know what gives you the authority to make that claim about what Carrie believes. I want you to defend your description. Then I'm responsible to give some kind of justification for my ascription. Now, I'm very careful here not to say evidence that I know, but I'm responsible for saying what makes me think that Carrie believes such a thing. And then I'm going to talk about various things you say on YouTube, or various things I've heard you say to your students, or various things that I've read. And if I knew you very well, and I spent time with you, and I saw your facial expressions, and I saw how pained you got when people deny that sort of view, and I see how you beat your head against the wall and stuff, then I can talk about, I can even say she feels very strongly about this, and I've even seen her face get white when the view is denied. These are all kinds of things that I'm able to appeal to when I want to say something about what Carrie believes. And I also can appeal to your thoughts, of course, because I've got access to your thoughts through your writing and through what you say and through what you teach. So nothing, though, and I think that this is something I've learned over time, nothing in that story commits you to there being something that's essentially hidden or something that I can never have access to. So in other words, you couldn't say that what it is for Carrie to really believe this is something that we'll never know and we never can know, because whether or not these processes are going on, not in her brain, according to you guys, if I'm right about this, but some sort of abstract level between the brain and the synapses and the electrochemical signals and all that, but something in between that and some of what you can attribute to her at the personal level. That sounds to me like I could never use that sort of layer in any of my justifications for why I would ascribe to you this perfectly normal belief that you have. And so your story doesn't actually match up with what we do when we defend our ascriptions of propositional attitudes. And not only that, if you were to suggest that you've got the theoretical advantage and that I should move toward your kind of approach, then I'd bring up all the problems that it's got. Like, how do you reconcile the causal story with the pattern story that I've just told you, the sense-making pattern? Are you committed to a view about causation that brings in something like psychological laws? How do you explain those laws? How do you explain the violability of those laws? Because now they're sounding a lot like the principles or norms of rationality that we began with, and so forth and so on. And there'd be a lot of stuff to talk about with self-knowledge too. That's the general picture. So what I'm not going to allow you to do in a very short response to your question is I'm not going to allow you to hijack the notions of thoughts and feelings and go cognitive with them. It looks like that's in the middle of kind of begging the question against the position I'm trying to recommend. How does that sound?
It does, although, I mean, it sounds like a robust answer. I suppose I'm trying to see. I mean, one of the worries here is that all these, you know, symptoms or well, you do use the disease metaphor or analogy in your book, but let's put it this way: if you want to, I take it, assert a stronger connection between my white face, my writings, what I say, and so forth, and the nature, if I can put it that way, of a propositional attitude or of a character trait. Whereas a cognitivist will say something like, those are all, you know, maybe they're, you know, very closely connected, you know, expressions of the thought or the feeling or whatever, but they're not defined in terms of that. They're expressions of it, but they are not sort of constitutive of it.
That's right. They'll if I can add to that on your behalf, they'll say, tell me if you like this. They'll say something like, we do our best with the conceptual resources we have to gesture at the real nature of propositional attitudes with our, what you're calling, Tanny, our propositional attitude expressions. But those propositional attitude expressions actually function to refer to something in the real world, call them propositional attitudes. And it's up to our best science and our best cognitive science in particular to figure out, to tell us what the nature of those attitudes, those properties, those events, those processes really are. You're doing your conceptual work, but you're not getting at the story of the phenomena. You're talking about the concept of mind, and you're not talking about mentality.
Right.
Right. So that captures the position nicely, right?
It is. It's certainly one way, and I might add to that, and then invite you to come back at it. Everything you say, perhaps about propositional attitudes, and you know, folk psychology in general, might very well have an explanation, the way you give it. But there is going to still be a story that that is mechanistic, that it does involve events in the brain that in some sense encode or represent. And those are going to be an essential part of any story of human behavior. So in a sense, the response is, you know, take your propositional attitudes. You know, that's folk psychology. Maybe those terms function the way you say they do, but we still want this other information processing story, and maybe they're just, you know, complementary stories. And the philosophy of mind that we've been talking about divides into two. You know, there's the rationality, reasons giving, patterns captured by our folk attitudes and so forth. And then there's these other, you know, cognitive items that we're looking for. And there's just two different stories to be given.
Okay. Well, let me just say something to correct, just to correct something that you said.
Sure.
Which is that, I'm going to have to come clean and say that if you think that propositional attitudes are the reference, as it were, of propositional attitude expressions, then I'm going to stop you there and say, actually, I don't think that the role of these expressions is to refer to something the nature of which is mysterious and needs somebody to investigate. I think that the expressions function in a way where we can tell a story and this layer, this cognitive layer, has got very little to do with that particular story. Now, as far as I also have to be very careful to make sure that it's understood that there's a certain philosophical rationale for the cognitive sciences that I find is within my target range, right within my target range. It's very different for me to characterize myself, and I don't think I would dare characterize myself as somebody who's critical of what gets done in the cognitive sciences, because for all I know, people could take, to use your language, an instrumentalist view toward their theoretical posits, and they could say it helps us to build robots if we look at this by doing some kind of functional boxology and whatever, and we look at it in terms of these tasks and whether or not the robots are actually working in this way or working with a different kind of architecture is neither here nor there. I have nothing to say about how people want to go ahead and get to whatever their solution is, if that's what they're trying to do, for example, build expert systems or build something like that. It's when philosophers say that it's that kind of work that's going to tell us about the nature of the mental that I can put my foot down and say, not unless it actually marries a lot more with what it is that I think we're all supposed to be investigating together. So I think at one point in the book, I confront somebody like the psychofunctionalist who says, yes, I actually might be straying quite a bit from what some people call folk psychology. But that's fine with me. Or I admit that my intuitions about swamp man or zombies go against common morality. But that's up to me as a scientist to recommend these kinds of conceptual changes, because this is the subject matter of my theorizing. It leads me here, and this is where I have to go. And I'm then free to say, well, hold on. I thought you were giving us a story about thinking or beliefs or intelligence or any number of these sorts of things. And these are words that these are concepts that don't belong to any particular theory. So you'd better show what the link is between my story and your story. And if we start diverging so much, then I'm going to put my foot down and say, I don't want to go in your particular direction. And just as an aside, I'm not also sure that there aren't going to be some people in your own kind of neck of the woods who want to say, what's that got to do with the brain? because there's certainly a wonderful story to be told about brain chemistry and gosh, I'm looking now, I'm working with some people looking at emotions and the amygdala and the hypothalamus, and I need to learn about this stuff. But I don't think I need to posit a layer of, by the way, either cognitive processes there inside the brain, as it were, or that supervene on the brain, nor do I would even do that even with something like an emotion. I would rather say, look, when people are angry, this sort of chemical gets secreted, blah, blah, blah. I don't see why I can't tell the two stories in a way that doesn't have to mix them in such complicated ways. That's where what I'm trying to explore now in my work to come. I don't like this crossing of pictures, as Wittgenstein would say, but that doesn't stop me from, I mean, I would be crazy to say that brain science isn't something that's going to teach us a lot, and maybe even, since my view about concepts is that we might be in for some concept revision, and we might eventually get rid of some of these concepts as we're learning more about the brain. I haven't caught up, and I don't think I'll ever catch up with Paul Churchland on this. I don't think that the kinds of concepts that we've been talking about are part of a folk theory. I think they're something that we're brought up with is in terms of a certain kind of practice. But there's no reason they can't evolve and they can't change in the light of certain kinds of empirical work. It's just that there's something about the cognitive layer that strikes me as unhelpful in a mixing of pictures. If you try to then use that layer to say that we're going to find out about the nature of mentality by looking at it, it might be perfectly useful to repeat if you're going to build machines or not. I mean, some people think that architecture is not very helpful.
So, I mean, it sounds like perhaps the question here is, I mean, I don't want to put it in terms of, you know, who gets to use the word mind or mentality. That's not a terribly interesting debate. But the interesting debate is whether what does go on in the brain, in a word, whether there is a missing middle here between mind, as you know, in terms of patterns of behavior or practices embodied, you know, in a society and in a whole body, and that's the level of mind. It's the organism and its environment, and then there's brain processing, and that's it. And the opposite view is, well, no, there's lots of different layers here. Some of those layers are going to be purely neural. And then there's going to be in between sort of information processing where, you know, information is encoded. We recall some of that in memory. We use it in thinking and perception. And that deserves to be called cognitive. Even if, you know, if I give you the word mind, and we don't want to quite call it mental. So do you deny that?
No, I think that's a very careful way to put it. And I think that kind of some of my worry is the philosophical claims that are made on behalf by philosophers that are made on behalf of what cognitive scientists do. And I think that's much more a target than some of the actual work that goes on. And I've never actually looked at the work that goes on to be critical of it. So I very much am within the philosophical sort of camp. And as you know, some of the people I take as opponents here are the people who do want to say this is how we learn about intelligence or the mind or what beliefs are or what even what rationality is. And you know that some people have actually made extraordinary claims. Some of the people writing in cognitive science or artificial intelligence literature as well are denying that we can make sense of freedom because of the mechanistic, or that we must give up the idea that we're free, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's no easy answer to this question, and I think that I have to be clear in saying that there are certain kinds of philosophical claims that are being made by philosophers on behalf of some of the work that gets done. And I think that if I were to sit down and talk to some of the cognitivists, the scientists who are doing some of this work and using this layer, as we're calling it, as a theoretical model, we might agree that wonderful progress is being made in terms of how we understand certain things like perception or memory. But I think if you were to then say that this is what perception is, I would have to remind you about all kinds of things involving how we use the expression see, hear, taste, etc., that might show that there are other things involved in anything that could be going on in this kind of strange layer. I mean, just to give you an example, the whole idea of zombies is a philosophical experiment that says there's something about a layer. It's not the cognitive layer, but it's the layer of what's it like layer, as it were. This is from another area of philosophy of mind. And without this phenomenological layer, then no matter what the person does, what they say, how white their face gets, how they react, how they complain, how they cry, how they do all this stuff, sorry, what the creature does, mm-hmm. We're not able to say that it's minded. And some of the people have drawn and have been quite explicit in saying that if I turned out to be a zombie, they would, even though they couldn't know it in principle, if they were to know it, they would reject me and want nothing to do with me before again. That, to me, that's extraordinary. So it's, again, I'm being very careful to say, look what you want to do. Where do you want to take these ideas? And let's talk about it. And then I show you where I'm going to put my foot down.
So, well, yeah, go ahead.
No.
You raised a question that has been an issue, you know, zombies, of course. And of course, as you are well aware, zombies are, you know, precisely the sort of case that many people in philosophy of mind will insist is a reason to reject any sort of behaviorist or functionalist or presumably Reilian some sort of account, precisely because all this evidence that you have for ascribing and that may be perfectly acceptable, and yet there's nothing going on inside. This is just a standard argument, right?
Yes.
So maybe you could say, you know, how you deal with those particular cases.
Yeah, I do by in fact questioning what they could possibly mean we start out by the idea of I think I know what you mean by what's going on inside. Now let's see what that's got to do with smelling and tasting and hearing and the other kinds of what's so-called consciousness concepts on one strand of what we might mean by consciousness. And then I imagine Zombie John and say about Zombie John, gosh, he's, let's compare him to real John. And lo and behold, if I'm worried about whether Zombie John, real John can see something or hear something, I perform the normal sorts of tests, and he passes those tests when he puts on his glasses or when he reacts in a certain way, et cetera, et cetera. And then I ask, what possible justification would I have? And now this isn't a matter of evidence. This is a matter of, again, my ability to back up my claim to use the descriptions that I'm using or to use the concepts that I'm using to apply to, as it were, to explain or to ascribe, as it were, to Zombie John. What possible reason would they be able to give for saying that, although I can do this with real John, I'm not allowed to use these very same justification conditions, as it were, for attributing these concepts to Zombie John? And I find that very odd. If I'm allowed to give the reasons, for example, that I gave for ascribing to you the belief that the mechanistic picture is the correct one, it's very, very strange that I can't do that for Zombie Carrie. And I think that if people realize that our consciousness concepts, those kinds of perceptual concepts, for example, the justification conditions for my ascribing them are met in all kinds of ways, but interestingly enough, they're all public kinds of ways. Now, that isn't to say that there might be something that I don't see, because it's something that's hidden from me, but it's not hidden from me in the way that the zombie justification conditions are somehow hidden from you. Those are in principle inaccessible, and always so. So something's gone wrong at the point of language here, because I don't even know what they mean when they say that Zombie John can't see. I would hire him for my, you know, or smell. If I'm opening up a perfume company and Zombie John performs the tests that I want and is able to distinguish patchouli from raw tobacco and all these wonderful wood scents that go into these male perfumes, and you were to say, don't be silly, he can't smell, I would just laugh at you. You can smell for the purposes of making perfume, thank you very much, and that's what I want for smelling, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, that sort of, in a sense, it's like, well, one response is, well, pain, you know, that's the standard one. But another one is that, before we were talking about the cognitive, the information processing, view and building robots and so forth. And it sounds like, on the one hand, we'll get an account by the cognitive, the information processing view, in which we are. Maybe we give, we build robots that can act in certain ways, and yet if we do, like as long as they do act in these certain ways, there's no reason to, you know, distinguish them from anybody else who has a mind, because the mind just is whatever satisfies our patterns that we use the terms to pick out, right, or to express. Is that have I confused matters?
No, I think that's right. I think I like your way of putting it. The way I would put it is that there are a bunch of different sorts of considerations that we use that would justify our ascriptions of these mental concepts. And if we were able to build, well, if we were able to build robots such as, was it Daniel and Steven Spielberg's AI, or like Rachel, or
E.T.?
Let me go with Rachel and whoever Harrison Ford's character is in Blade Runner.
Yeah, the replicant.
The replicants, that's right. These are all supposed to, these run foul of historical representational accounts in philosophy of mind. And I think that's extraordinary that they would be denied, as they are, moral status in the films, because they're not considered to have minds. I don't see any, you're using the word mind in a different way if you say that from, you're using, sorry, not the word mind, but of course the word mind is itself an abstraction over all kinds of abilities.
Right.
And if you build something that's got all of these abilities and it's got all of these other kinds of characteristics that I have these, even, gosh, I'll even have these feelings toward them, as happens in these programs where the people have faces, including E.T., right? It's something about their facial expressions that's very, very important here. I find the idea extraordinary that we would deny the mentality. So I have nothing to say about, oh gosh, whether or not such things could be built, or whether they could be found in other planets. But if I would have to say, if they were, then you'd it almost sounds like brute prejudice, speciesism,
yeah,
to deny them mentality. Well, now, just about pain, because yeah, you're right, that's going to be something that will be brought up. And I think it's true that people can they can try to hide their pain behavior. They can try, but even when they're trying to hide their pain behavior, I think you can often tell when something isn't quite right. But if you try, as Putnam suggested in an early article, that we could actually completely divorce the connection between pain on the one hand and pain behavior on the other, so that it is a pure causal, that is, contingent connection between the one and the other. And he agrees that he's committed to the idea that a race could be in excruciating pain and we'd never know it because they'd behave just like us. Just try. I mean, just as an experiment, pick your favorite romantic novel. Get the bit where Scarlett and Rhett are just getting together and they're looking into one another's eyes and about to whatever. And ask yourself to imagine now that one of them is in excruciating pain. And but not, but the, I think he says something like the hell of the you know, the something excruciating beyond all description. And I think you'll do what you just did, Carrie. I think you'll just start giggling because you're not going to know what it is you're supposed to be asked to do here.
So let me. We're running close on time, so I do want to just ask a rather flat-footed question at this point, which is, we were talking about, you know, what gets called part of mind and what doesn't, and I'm just curious. So, are you saying that experiences? Shouldn't really, I mean, the things that we, you know, feel, I mean, intuitively, and they're subjective, and we can hide them to some degree. Are you saying that that's just not part of what mental terms are all about?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. I mean, we were talking about propositional attitudes for most of the, well, propositional attitude expressions, I want to say, for most of the discussion. And then when we started moving to feelings, I think the philosophical view that I don't like is that feelings are, they might be, as it were, form some sort of layer on their own that's got no kind of, conceptual link, if you want, to the characteristic behavior or characteristic physiological reactions, et cetera, et cetera. My real enemy here is the people who think that the word pain the expression sees green is given its meaning by something that only the person who's seeing it, as it were, can experience. That's the view that I find objectionable. I don't find the view that we see things and that we hear things and that we feel certain ways that only we can express. But I don't think that you are going to be able to make anything of a private language, which is what some people want to do from those kind of ordinary considerations. On the contrary, I think that we learn how to express these feelings by using the language that we all speak.
So it's the only claim that you object to.
Which is that?
That such terms only refer to these sort of inner feelings, experiences, whatever.
Well, we'd have to have another long conversation about what we mean by inner, and then I think what we would probably do is come to an agreement about the way that it makes sense to call them inner, which would not land us with something so inner that we would never ever be able to know if they were having these experiences in principle.
Right.
That's how I would try to take that conversation.
Fair enough. So we're almost out of time. And so I would like to know where are you going next? I mean, are you working on a follow-up series of essays or book? What's your next project?
Well, I've got a couple. I'm trying to consolidate some of my work on Ryle, because I've been doing some quite a lot of work on trying to get probably a better statement of what I think Ryle is up to than you see in a lot of the literature on him. So that's a slow burning, as it were, a slow cooking project. And I'm also interested in developing, trying to bring out this what I call philosophy, but trying to bring out this manner of doing it in a way that's a little bit more explicit, so that it brings together some of the, I mean, I'm calling it partly because Ryle and Wittgenstein also talk about it this way, but I call it conceptual cartography. And it's a way of, as it were, investigating important philosophical ideas or concepts, but by looking at the kind of commitments that we have, the kind that I've been talking to you about with respect to ascriptions of beliefs, for example, or pain, and trying to show how some of that sort of approach, which is in common between Ryle and Wittgenstein, but also I think Wisdom, John Wisdom, is much overlooked and has a lot to say. And I think somehow at some point we're going to come into conflict with what we learn to do Anglo-American philosophers have wanted to do in terms of following trying to reconcile what people were doing with the formalizing their their logic instead of using just sorts of informal logic. I think that, I suspect that there's going to be a tension there, and I'm interested in one day kind of working that out.
Oh, very good. So I think we are now officially out of time, but I want to thank you for a wonderful discussion.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. So thanks again, and I look forward to reading your further work.
Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Julia Tenney, reader in philosophy of mind at the University of Kent, about her new book, Rules, Reasons, and Self-Knowledge, just out from Harvard University Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed our podcast, and thank you for listening.